The Jazz Scene Podcast gives an in-depth look at the lives and stories of the musicians performing in Columbus and beyond. This episode features NEA Jazz Master and 7-time Grammy Award winner, Maria Schneider. The Jazz Arts Group of Columbus spent the week with Maria during our historic 50th season as she led the Columbus Jazz Orchestra at the Southern Theater. Today's recording is from our live interview at the Jazz Academy, hosted by Artistic Director Byron Stripling.
Thank you, and thank you all for being here. I want to, Michael, put you on the spot. You heard this music last night, and I could tell from your enthusiasm, talked a little bit, that you loved it. Could you just share a second of what you loved about it and what it did for you?
Yeah, it was interesting. You were very accurate when you said we're going to take a journey or take a ride. I was kind of ready to settle into a nice jazz, groove, and where you illustrated a story, first verbally, and then the band followed. And then it was so cool because so many different members of the band stood up and had their solos. And not only soloed, they were nailing it. And it was just such a great experience. I haven't stopped listening to your music since we left. I put your CD in my car, and I ran errands this morning just so I could listen to it. So
that's great.
So thank you.
Wow.
Really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, well, I just want to say it's a feather in my cap to have musicians like this play my music. And there's so many amazing people in this band that are bringing just magnificent solos, the rhythm section. I mean, it's just mind-blowing. And, the whole reason I'm a jazz composer, because last night I talked about the Dawn Upshaw project. And the first piece I wrote for her, classical, for the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, I had no improvisation. I conducted it 3 nights in a row. I felt so lonely at the end of the night for the interaction with the players talking about what each other contributed and played. It was kind of like people were really nice, and, it went great. Yeah, beautiful. That was wonderful on that clarinet line or whatever. But it's different than when somebody comes and puts something on the music that's never happened before, that you didn't imagine. There's yet another unique way to play the music. And for me, I thrive on that. Going someplace and the music becomes something different. And that's what I love. And that's why I'm a jazz composer. And that's why I think I will always be a jazz composer. I don't really have a desire to write music that doesn't have improv. But you have to give the improvisers something to tell in the story. If you're going to write these story pieces, it can't just be, this person's going to blow now. But the player has to know where they're going from and where they're going to, so they create a sense of inevitability in the music. And that takes a certain kind of skill and respect and lack of ego to not just be somebody that just wants to show everything you can do, but to make it happen for the music, so.
Yeah. I want to go to a couple, jump around a little bit, but before I do, I do want to acknowledge Pete, who's here, who is playing so amazing. I just, from Old Black Magic to the other one that you do later as a feature, and I don't see any other band members, but the band, it was just like we were talking about with John, they love your music, and they work in a different way getting prepared for this that I've never seen. But it's because of the love of the music, and like, this is going to be special. So hats off to Pete and Michael Cox and Dwight and Bobby Floyd and Jim Powell and all these guys. It's just like, and they love it, and the music gets better because they have something to work from, and that's your music. I'd love to go to, is it, and then I'm going to go back, but is it Torque's Cafe?
Torque's Cafe, yeah.
Yeah, okay, we played that last night, and you should know that everything that Maria does has kind of a story to it. And I'm struck by this thing, that a waitress, it's a cafe. You were a waitress?
A truck stop, which is at Torx, yeah.
At a truck stop. And I just want to read something, because I've thought about this, and there's different scenarios of this, because waitressing is a crazy thing.
Oh,
1938, Franklin Roosevelt signed the first minimum wage law into effect, but it excluded waitresses. For support, women often were waitresses, but they're like, we're going to cut you off there, so which means that you are solely dependent upon the tip. Even now, women are disparaged, like you had some example of, what was that thing you said, I want you, but the dressing.
Oh, yeah, I can't. What can I get you? I'll have you, baby, with no dressing.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
A real charmer.
Right.
Not to mention I was underage, you know. It's right. Like.
So this is where I'm going with this. And so you this whole thing with women, and during COVID, by the way, and I'm going to stop talking, but because I had a friend of mine wrote an article in the New York Times about this. Many of her friends, we were required to wear the masks during COVID. And men would come up to these women, they're sitting at the table ready to order, say, honey, let me see your face.
Oh.
And it's like my boss said, you know, we're COVID protocols, we're trying not to do that. No, honey, you want a good tip? Now, remember, they're working below minimum wage. You want a good tip? I need to see your face, honey, and see how cute you are.
Ew.
Right? So I have this sense there's a little bit of that in Torx Cafe, but can you seem to have, with every song, you need a muse. You need something to work from. And so there was definitely something there. Can you help me with Torx Cafe and what all that meant for you?
When I sit down to write, a lot of times I'm just looking for sound that I like. And a lot of times looking for personality in an idea. And a lot of times what happens is when I sit down and do that, all of a sudden in my mind I'm seeing some event in my life or some experience, or it's attaching itself to some idea, and it almost becomes like a film score of my own life. And once that happens, I sat down and wrote that, and I said, well, this is Torx Cafe. This is I'll Have You, Baby, with No Dressing. This is like, you know, just the kind of, you know, I mean, it was a nice place. There were a lot of wonderful farmers that came there, but there were a lot of seedy characters in stories I can't really tell that went on at Torx. But, you know, it was a scary place to open up early in the morning, and you know it's on the highway, and it's just you know people come through towns, and you know anyway. So that's what I'm looking for—a little bit of that sleaze in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so just the point on that one too is that you seem to need something that brings you there, or in that case it was Torx, but something inspires that.
That's what makes writing fun for me, is when it becomes not about me and my musical ideas, but it becomes about me using my whatever I know about music to make this thing come to life. And I think part of it is, basically, I'm a pretty insecure person. It doesn't seem like it because I talk easily, I tell personal stories on a mic or whatever. That's sort of a genetic inappropriateness that I got in my family. But in high school, I couldn't even read out loud in a class without my voice shaking and not being able to breathe almost. You know, I was so scared. And you know, when we were at he went to Eastman, Byron, and me too. And remember Joel McNeely?
Yes, of course.
Some of the lessons we learn in life are tough lessons that a teacher says or a fellow student, and I was always saying, oh, you know, I'm terrible, oh, it didn't sound good, you know, and I really felt that. And Joel said to me one day, he said, you know, if you just keep saying that, Maria, people are going to start to believe it. And it was a real ouch moment, but isn't it amazing? I remember that because I remember thinking, okay, I got to turn this around. I don't want people to believe it. Would I be here at Eastman trying to do this if I really believed at least there wasn't a chance I could make something of value, you know? And so I think when I write music, I don't often, it takes the attention off of me to have something to write for. that's why I think I loved writing music for the Ted Kooser poetry, because now it's about this poetry I love and trying to write music that makes it just come to life and be its own thing. It's separate from me. It's the flashlight isn't on me and my musical ideas, but it's on taking people to a place, you know, that I'm imagining, and I want people to come with me to that place. It is a little bit like, so what, Frank Kimbrough, my pianist in my band, died during the COVID period, and we had a memorial for him, and I said something about him, but I think it's, for me, similar. Maybe I won't. I said with Frank, it's not look at me, it's come with me. You know, he wasn't like flashy, like check me out, all this I can do, and if he gets something together, doing it again and again. But he always wanted to take people someplace. And I love that. That's why I do this.
Mm-hmm. That's great, great. Can we go back to Eastman for a second? Because it's a great place to learn. You and I both went there. Pete Mills went there. Maybe somebody else in here. Hard school to get into. You're the renowned 7 Grammys, nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. You didn't get accepted in the first time.
No.
Tell us that story.
Well, it's very understandable, and, you know, hats off to Ray Wright, who became such an amazing teacher for me. I dreamed of going there. I'd open up those downbeats, and everybody there was winning the downbeat awards and stuff for me at that, when I was young and in undergrad. That was somehow the hallmark of success, I guess. And, but I was very inexperienced. I didn't come through a jazz program. I came from a small town. University of Minnesota didn't have a jazz program. But I'll tell you what they had. They had a big band with a guy conducting. His name was Dr. Frank Ben Cresciuto. Mm-hmm. You've heard of him?
I lived in Minnesota, so yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, and he did wind ensemble stuff. He was also a very good friend of Bill Evans, pianist Bill Evans. And so he had a big band, and I had a classical teacher there that said, you know, I started listening to so much jazz, and he said, your music's sounding so influenced by jazz, I don't know what I can do for you. I think you should go watch the big band rehearse and start writing for them. And so then I took some lessons with a guy in the band. His name was Bob Parsons, who was doing some writing, and then I took some lessons with a man in the community that was an arranger, Lance Strickland. Then I found the great Manfredo Fest, Brazilian pianist who had played with Sergio Mendes, amazing player. He was blind. He had unbelievable ears. I mean, I would walk in and he'd say, okay, Maria, play, you know, Autumn Leaves. And then he'd come back and he'd play back my entire hideous solo, you know. But I just searched people out. And then the other really cool thing was in school, there were a lot of people, we were all checking out the same things, and we would talk and share ideas and check out this voicing I found, and we were searching. We didn't look for teachers to lead us because there weren't that many. Reginald Buckner was a piano teacher there. I took a piano class with him, but I was learning on my own by groping, and I'll tell you what, it's a great way to learn, because you develop your own unorthodox ways of doing things. That if you were in a class and letting yourself be spoon-fed every technique, you would just learn the techniques that are being spoon-fed to you. So by the time, so when I applied to Eastman, Ray Wright wrote me a letter, and he said, I feel like you have some talent. I hope I still have this letter. I might. But you don't have enough experience. Would you like to come out to our summer arrangers holiday where for 3 weeks, you know, you can really learn and get experience? This thing was amazing. And Byron played in it. They had a big band. They had a studio orchestra. The strings all from the Rochester Philharmonic. They also had an engineering 3-week program where kids would learn engineering from all over the world. They would record multi-track. And so for 3 weeks, I didn't sleep. I was going to prove to Ray Wright that I can get into this place someday, you know? And I just pushed and pushed and pushed, and I went to University of Miami for a short period. To this day, I love that school, and I'm involved with them now with their wonderful Henry Mancini Institute, and they have this wonderful studio orchestra. But they didn't have that at that time, and they also didn't have film scoring, and I was really interested in film scoring. So I heard that Matt Harris, remember Matt Harris?
Of course.
This guy, Andy Weinsler, remember Andy Weinsler?
Friends,
all these great musicians. Andy Weinsler said to me one day, I heard that Matt Harris, and he was in the program at Eastman, I heard he's going on the road with Maynard. There might be a spot open. So I called up Ray Wright, and he said, well, send me some things you're doing, and I'll decide. And he let me in at the half semester, and then I was in. But then came the tears every night calling home. Everybody's so good, I can't do this. You know, I was so panicked. The level was so Hi. Did you feel that? You came in a genius.
I told you my story, and I bet Pete has this. Pete went to Eastman too, but I walked in the first day at Eastman, and I walked by a practice room, and there were five sax players, including like Rob Lockhart on the fingerprint, Andy Weinsler, Brian Scanlon, and two, three others. They were in a circle, and they were jamming to Cherokee with a metronome clicking on 2 and 4, and they were just like eating it up, like,
yeah.
I was like, well, if everybody plays like this, I'm in the wrong school.
Yeah.
Because I can't do anything close to that.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So that was like an Eastman experience.
Yeah, I felt like that too. Pete, did you have any of that, or did you come in?
Oh, I had all of that.
Yeah. I think we all did. I'll tell you what happened. So years later, I gave the commencement address at Eastman. That was kind of surreal. You know, I didn't get into this place, and now I'm giving the commencement address. And I started out saying, you know, I understand the terror of coming to a place, the level being so high, and when I first applied, I didn't get in. People erupted like, yeah!
Wow.
And afterwards, a girl came up to me. She had applied 3 times as a flute person, and then she was like tops in the studio. So it's, you know, it can be a real killer to the sense of making music sometimes to be in an environment like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's because you're constantly comparing yourself to each other. And music is something that, you know, we can't all do the things that each other do, and we shouldn't do. And it's easy to forget what's important about music, the light that first lit you up. I was thinking about it with the educational event yesterday. The first aesthetic, heart-stirring experience that we have in life that makes us maybe want to be a musician. The guy who manages at the hotel restaurant,
mm-hmm.
I was talking to him about the educational event yesterday. I said, you got to go over and check this out. It was so amazing. And he said, well, in St. Louis, it was a thing like that. He said, it changed my life. Made me want to play, instruments. He said, I played trumpet, I played trombone. You know, he's clearly a very confident, together guy. And he said it was an event like that that lit him up. And it's just so important. And then that spark as a musician, a lot of times it's sad because musicians can lose that spark first because they start judging, the self-judging and comparing. And anyway.
Yeah. Do you mind, how old is your mom?
98.
She, and correct me if I'm wrong, she must have had an influence on you. She must be a powerful lady because of who you are. I'm just speculating here. Like you could have had great influence from your father, too, and your family. But if you wouldn't mind saying if that was an influence.
Both were, and the women in Wyndham. So a lot of times people ask me about being a woman. You know, I don't have much to say about being a woman in jazz because it's all I know. But here's what I will say. Well, my mother always had music on around the house. You know, she had a lot of records. She played piano. She was a pretty good pianist. I mean, we had a horrible Baldwin Acrosonic. You can't even call that thing a piano. It's hideous. It's like a little piano-like console. But she could play beautiful Chopin, and she made sure that we would have lessons, even though we were from this tiny town. So I took dance lessons. I took, you know, everything that I could. But the amazing thing in Wyndham was the woman who inspired me to do music, Miss Evelyn Butler. She had been from Chicago. She was a stride pianist, a classical pianist. She only ended up in Wyndham because her husband and son both died of cancer in 1 month, and her daughter lived in Wyndham. So this amazing pianist, and she turned out to be an amazing teacher, came to Wyndham. So my role model there was a woman. I had a sister who was very good in theater. The person who did most of the theater stuff in the high school, she was a woman. My other sister was a painter. And my mom's closest friend and this amazing painter in the community, Pat Miller, was a kind of a mentor for my sister. So we had role models. Now my dad was an engineer, extremely masculine, a kind of type A person, and he was a duck hunter and a fisherman. And I was the third daughter to come around, and that was a real disappointment, I'm sure. So by age 8, you know, I had the 20-gauge shotgun in my hand, and you're going to learn to shoot a duck, you know. And I'm a big bird lover, you know, maybe partly from that. But so I hung out as a kid a lot with men, and great men, you know, really wonderful. My dad had fantastic friends, and they never treated me like the little girl that wasn't a good shot or that couldn't go and, you know, out in the boat and get that duck with her or whatever, or, you know, chop the decoys out of the ice or whatever it was. You know, they treated me just like one of them. And I think that was a really important formative thing for me. Mm-hmm. I never felt like I never even had the thought that I'm a girl and those are all a whole lot of boys in this big band or whatever. I never thought about it until people later asked me. And now I've gone back and thought, well, why was I so, you know, oblivious? And I think it might be those elements, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of just answered my question, because you're essentially, your job now is you manage men. You have women in your band,
mm-hmm.
but you've got these...
There's a lot of men. There's many more men in this business, yeah.
Right, but you lead them. I mean, you came into our rehearsal, and it's like, let's go.
Yeah, I don't think about it, you know.
Yeah.
Because when you're making music, I mean, I will say, when I see videos of me conducting, it's always a shock. It's like, oh, wow. Because looking out through my eyes, I'm not seeing myself. What I'm seeing is music ain't sounding right. You know, you need to do this. You need to hit this harder. You guys, you need to attack. You know, that's where my head is. Not, oh, I'm, you know, female in front of this group. And one thing I learned throughout the years, because in the beginning with working as a guest with bands, if I did worry what people thought about me, I learned pretty quickly that everybody in the band is only worried about what everybody's thinking about them. They're not thinking about me, they're worried about themselves. So a huge job for me is trying to get everybody sounding good and everybody feeling okay.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if somebody's playing something wrong again and again, you can't really help them through that. There's only one way, and that's learn it. But, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I remember our last time you were with us, we had a piano player, and you said, you know, I need it to go, and like I've seen you do, and you'll sit and you'll play it, like, I need it to be like this. And then you probably don't even remember this because it just came out of your mouth. And he goes, well, that's really hard. And you looked at him and said, well, that's your job.
I do.
And then all that made me sit up and go, okay, better get my stuff together here.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. I mean, it may be hard, but, you know, sorry. You know, I'm here, you're there. You gotta do it.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it.
Well, that was that left a lasting impression upon me. Can we move to your influences and people that inspired you? And I know there's two people, if you could tell us, because a lot of our people might not know. In some cases, you're a music copyist or just helping and working with them. So two people, could you tell us who they were? Gil Evans, who was he, and what did you do with him, how he inspired you? And also Bob Brookmeyer, I know you worked a little some things with him. If you could just sort of tell people who they were and how you interacted and how that influenced you.
Yeah, so when I left Eastman, I didn't want to just go into a world of working, and all of a sudden my education stops. Back then, the National Endowment had these apprenticeship grants where you could study with somebody. And I wanted to study with Gil Evans, and Bill Dobbins said, no, he doesn't teach. He's kind of a recluse. He's always smoking pot. You know, you can't do that. But I decided I was going to call him anyway. I just, you know, and I called. Do you remember the phones at the phone booth at the end of the hall in the dorm?
In all the dorms, and people would call you, and they'd say, you got a phone call from so-and-so.
Yeah, it was one
phone. No texting, no nothing. Like
this is, we all, you know what we had? We had our books, our music we were working on, and each other, and our record players.
And our records, yeah.
And our records, that was it. So all we did was talk about music, share music, listen to music. It was such a better world, I'll tell you.
It was.
But I went down anyway to that dial phone and called information in New York, in Manhattan, and they gave me the number to Gil Evans. I couldn't even believe that. And then I called, and there was an answering machine, and it said, if you wish to speak to Gil or Miles, speak after the beep. And I was like, holy crap, they live together? I can't do this. And I hung up. And so then I thought, well, what am I going to do? And I thought, well, maybe I'll study with Bob Brookmeyer because I love Brookmeyer too, and I'll talk about what
and
I
so
love.
So these two people are some of the greatest composer arrangers in ever.
Gil's. I can say what I loved about both of them because they both are the reason why I do what I do. And there were other people whose music I loved, you know, Mingus, Ellington, Thad Jones. But there were two things about these two people contrasting. Gil's music had the transparency, the color, the delicacy of classical music, you know, and I was a lover of classical music too. And it had all that emotive quality. It wasn't like, you know, that it didn't have the bassy drive or whatever, but it had nuance, a different kind of nuance, a more delicate kind of nuance. And I just was in love with it. And then his music had evolved and to be kind of more wild and free. And I really love that too. Albums like Svengali, Priestess. I felt a kinship with it. Bob Brookmeyer, so jazz has largely since the beginning been a theme and variations art in terms of form. People play, there's a song, and then people improvise on the song, and then, you know, there's the song happens again, and we're out. And people arrange that way, and maybe they add little transitions, but essentially, it's theme and variations. Bob Brookmeyer started breaking apart form, taking a tune and developing it like you would a classical piece from the motif. You know, he did a My Funny Valentine that doesn't sound anything like My Funny Valentine. It's like almost like a deconstruction, like a Picasso deconstruction of a face or something. And I just love that because that spoke to the classical side of me that loved long form and didn't want to always feel hemmed in by theme and variation, even though theme and variation is a wonderful thing and many of the pieces we're playing are sort of theme and variation form. Certainly not hang gliding, but Walking by Flashlight is. It's a song. So those two people, I knew that I wanted to somehow approach. And so then, so I called up Bob, and Bob was so intimidating on the phone. He said, oh, you want to study with me? What's your burn? And he said it like in a way he was really angry. And I'm like, I don't know what's a burn? Hey, what is it you want to do? And I said, well, I just want to be a better writer. Okay, well, come to New York and drop off your scores and some tapes. And I did that, and he accepted me. So I moved to New York, and I'm studying with Bob Brookmeyer. And Bob at that time was super into modern classical music. Mm-hmm. And he wanted me to do all these, you know, and one thing I didn't say, I had been traumatized by classical music at the University of Minnesota, and I'll tell you why. I went into college in 1979. Classical music at that time, if it wasn't all atonal, you know, pitch set theory, interval chain link theory, if it wasn't some theoretical, you know, mind-blowing, you know, thing. If it was just beautiful melody and harmony, you were considered just out, passé. You know, that's it. No, no room for you. And so, you know, and what I loved about the jazz world is your music could be pop-influenced. It could be traditional jazz-influenced. It could be in the direction of Gil Evans, Bob Brookmeyer, David Sanborn, or Cecil Taylor. And it was all of it was appreciated on its own merit. I mean, some people didn't, who maybe liked Cecil Taylor, maybe didn't like David Sanborn or whatever. But there was a place for things. In the classical world, there was no place for tonal music. So I was like, I was ready to ditch classical music. I almost switched to physics and astronomy in college. Seriously. I was just so turned off, and I took an astronomy class. I'm not smart enough for that, but I, for a moment, imagined maybe I could be. So anyway, I started studying with Bob. Bob, my first lesson, he came at me with all this classical modernism stuff. And I literally broke into tears, and I was like, I can't do this. I just come from this. You know, and for him, it was where he was going. And at the time, he was dating a woman who was a composer. And she told him, leave her alone. You need to just follow her. You shouldn't lead her. It was really nice. He told me this, you know. And so we went about our lessons in a different way than he did with most of his students. And we had such a great relationship, and I just loved him so much. It was amazing. And then at the same time, I started working as a music copyist in an office in New York. That's how I made my living for 8 years full-time, being a music copyist. And I copied for Brookmeyer then. And one day at the Xerox machine, a guy, Tom Pearson was his name, he came in. I Xeroxed his score, and we got talking because it was this huge classical thing. And we ended up getting lunch. And then he said, well, who do you love? And I was talking about Brookmeyer and Gil, and I was saying all the things I love about Gil. And then we decided we were going to go to this Penderecki concert at Carnegie Hall together. So he called that night, and he said, okay, I have to tell you something. I didn't tell you today, but Gil is my closest friend. And I called him. And he wants to meet you. He needs an assistant. And that's how I started working with Gil. And so just being around Gil, and yes, Gil did smoke a lot of pot. He wasn't a recluse, and he was very wonderful. But he wasn't a theoretical kind of person like Bob was. Even though in his own music he was very studious, he'd go to the library, he studied a ton, and transcribed he learned by transcribing, you know, in the old days. And, you know, from both of them, what I maybe most learned is that they were so individualistic. And they were both intimidated by one another. Mm. Gil would talk about Bob with such reverence and kind of like the thing I was talking about before, comparing yourself, sort of comparing himself, like Bob's here and, you know, I don't do that. And then Bob talking about Gil, oh my gosh, he's so elegant. And Bob had that same thing with Gil. Bob's here. I always felt like I had to be delicate talking about the other or with each other. But basically the point of it all that I took away was, if I want to find my individual voice, I need to start a band. That's how you find your voice in music, not by trying to write something for the Mel Lewis band in the style of Mel and trying to write for this and do that. That's great, and you can learn amazing skills, and there's a few amazing arrangers in that way. But I wanted to find something individual in myself, and I didn't know how to do that, but I knew having a band would help it.
Yeah, for sure. And I will say that once you took off totally on your own, I think it was a game changer, I feel, for your music. To have your own band, your own thing, just you, you soared like so quickly, because it was immediately apparent, like, this is what this music is about. Like, it's my concept in my head.
Yeah, the music that was on my first album, Evanescence, some of it I wrote at Eastman last season in Goomba Blue. Those were recital pieces for like a smaller Gil Evans size band. I still play them to this day with my band. Yeah. And then I started studying with Bob, and I wrote Wurgly, was so you could hear things start to break apart. So he had his effect, and my first lesson with Bob was so good. So intimidating, horrible and good all at the same time. One of those things you don't realize is good for you until 10 years later. So I brought in, he said, I want you to write something I've told Mel Lewis about you. I want you to write something for the Mel Lewis band. And I brought in this tune that I wrote. It was an AABA tune. And I showed him and I'd arranged it. And he's looked at it. And I could just tell there was just serious disapproval. But it was just a vibe coming from him. And then he said, why is there a solo there? I said, well, you know, it's got the head and a send-off, and now comes the solo. He said, a solo should only happen when the only thing that can happen is a solo. He said, why is the bass player playing on those chord changes? It's like, well, I wanted to say, well, hello, those are the chord changes of the tune. That is what they do, right? You know, and I was, by that point, I was just like, I don't know. You know, he's just feeling apologetic. He said, well, he could play on anything. He could play, you know, you could give him a pitch set or, you know, he went with his thing. But what he was basically saying is every aspect of the music can be anything. Why are you giving over your choices to what's been done 1,000 times in music? Should a solo happen there? Well, maybe because of this piece you wrote, but then why AABA? And I started to realize that I was writing music like people put together prefab houses. Maybe you put on a new gable and you get to pick your trim and you pick, a new front door of some sort that's kind of unique and a little bit of unique landscaping. But essentially, it's the prefab house that somebody put together, as opposed to like a Gaudi, you know, that's got all these surfaces and angles that can be anything. And so Bob started making me see the possibilities. And you know what? That's what made me find my voice. In retrospect, I said to Bob, you're the one, like 15 years after the fact, I said, you're the one that helped me find my voice. And he said, well, how did I do that? I said, because you made me question everything to look for what I wanted. And when I looked for what I wanted, my music became mine without me trying to figure out, you know, this is who I want to be. A lot of people try to find individualism in jazz or in something by putting on a hat, you know, of, you know, Moroccan music. You know, I'm going to do that and it'll be unique and these rhythms and whatever, or I'll play more notes or make my harmony more dense. It really can be something very simple, just sitting down and just saying, what should happen here? And that's very difficult. What has to happen next? What feels inevitable? What feels like a surprise that is the kind of surprise that makes you say, oh, yeah, to the listener, you know, keep coming with me because I promise that surprise is going to pay off and you're going to realize it wasn't just, you know, some errant idea. You know, so anyway, I forgot the question, but they.
Me too, but it's all great stuff you're saying. we're going to have to wrap up soon, but I want to get a couple things in. I want to go back to the beginning. We were talking about the muse, the things that inspire you. And I tried to categorize you, and it's probably the wrong thing to do, but I'm going to do it anyway. It seems like if I look at what we're playing to here this week, inspired by events like hand gliding or whatever.
Hang gliding.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Inspired by poems.
Yeah.
I categorize this inspired by fear, monsters, and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's in your brain somewhere. And possibly, but because it's personal, you don't need to talk about it, but possibly I feel, and I've told the audience every night, I feel love, and I feel hope, and I feel even healing. And mm-hmm. I kind of put those two together. Is there any of those you'd care to talk about?
Well, I feel like music, I mean, my dad built a bomb shelter. I said he was an engineer. And it was really deep in the...
Whoa.
Really deep in the earth.
But you're in the middle of Minnesota.
Yeah, but there were nuclear warheads and stuff out there in the edge of South Dakota.
Yeah.
So it was a hot spot for, you know. Yeah. And the door was right by my bed. And I was terrified of monsters. So maybe there is something to that. I didn't even really think about that exactly till now. I did write a piece called Bomb Shelter Beast. And I have Dance You Monster to my soft song, yeah. which the students are going to play. But to me, music is a healing force. I mean, I found music and it, my childhood was a wonderful childhood, but we had our stress in my family. Every family has their stress of their own kind and making, and music for me was my way of coping. Absolutely. Getting lost in the music. And so, you know, the idea of Kooser's poetry being healing and me feeling in love with that, my latest album, Data Lords, just being inundated and really worried about our world and big data, it starts to come into the music, you know.
I'm going to ask you about that in detail in a second.
There's one piece that probably was the most important piece I ever wrote for me as a musician. And it's on my album, Concert in the Garden, and it's called Bulería Soleá y Rumba. Sort of a flamenco influence thing. I listened to nothing but flamenco for years. I love flamenco. And that piece was a commission by Jazz at Lincoln Center for my band. And right in the middle of writing it, and I was behind anyway, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I was so freaked out. The same day I found out my best friend was dying of breast cancer. I was so completely freaked out by the commission. I've always hated commissions because they feel like so much pressure, and I just hate that. And so I said, okay, I'm going to call Jazz at Lincoln Center tomorrow and tell them I can't do this. You know, I'm just going to cancel. For sure they'll understand. They don't have to pay me for the commission. We'll just do the concert. And that night I sat down and, you know, it's like after I made that decision, it was like, oh, God, what a relief. Take that pressure off of me. But then all of a sudden it was like the fear, you know, the panic was in me about life, you know. Am I going to live? Am I going to die? What's going to happen to my friend? All of it. Seeing the worst case scenarios. And I felt like there was electricity just shooting through my body. I was just, the stress level was so unhealthy. And I was sitting at my piano, and then I had all those notes in front of me, you know, for this commission that was 2 weeks away from having to be delivered, and I had nothing enough there. But I started looking at what I had, and I started playing little ideas, and all of a sudden as I played, I got into the music, and all of a sudden I realized I was still seeing those scenarios, but they were up there and they weren't affecting me. It was like I was seeing the worst case scenario, but I was underneath the waves, and the music was just bringing me to this place of beauty and calm. And I realized for the first time, I do this for me. Not for the teacher at Eastman, not to compete with the person next to me, not for the commission or the money or the notoriety. I do this for me. We forget that, you know? And so that's the thing I try to remember, and I still hate commissions. You know, I really hate them because it's so easy to feel that pressure. But, and I know that's the thing that I talk about with students. Don't forget what music gives us when we're young, you know, that light that lights us up, that those kids that saw your band play, that they get lit up, and then they do music, but then they start judging themselves. Yes, you have to judge yourself to get better. You have to be a self-critic. But to a point, not to the point that you snuff out that light, you know? Does that make sense?
That's incredible. Thank you. Do you have time? Can we do one more question? I want you to. I know that you testified before Congress, which are an intimidating bunch of, once again, whole bunch of men in there who were out to score political points and stuff. So if you have a second to talk about that, and I want to also put that within, you're kind of almost advocating for musicians in general, which you always do. So along with that comes how you were one of the first people that got crowdfunding and you started creating your own albums in your own way, your own music in your own way. You raised the money, and I was just telling somebody outside, it's like I probably, when I was in New York and all that, probably must have played 500 albums and jingles and all that kind of stuff. And I get a check once a year for like $40, you know, just from all this work I've done, supposedly just residuals for all the great sales that they've had. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you saw that in one way, and you were like, this math does not make sense. Somebody's profiting. So you can talk about those things, as, and then I guess get Data Lords in there, the whole thing you did with that, and you were sort of, because when, I'll just finish with this, when you're talking about taking chances and doing things different, that can be a negative in the eyes of maybe a consumer audience. People want to just hear, and that's the difficulty of bringing new work into even the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, because the audience might go, well, I know Count Basie, and I know Duke, and Stan Kenton, and these guys. What's this Maria going to do? It's like, is it going to be the same? Because if it's going to be the same, I'll be there. But if not, I don't know. Maybe I should skip this particular concert. So then there's the dollar thing that comes in being a creative artist that jazz musicians deal with all the time. So you have sort of created a template as a way of being an artist that I think is so unique and individual to, and you influence a lot of people to do so. So you go ahead and
well,
answer how you want.
So the last part that you talked about, that was more of a problem when you're doing a record for a record company that's paying for it and taking on the financial risk. So they want you to be a certain thing because they don't want to lose. So in the old days, record companies, they made a profit on about 1 out of 12 records. So, you know, well, we've all gone through our periods of, you know, dissing record companies or whatever. The truth is, they were basically like banks where they put up the money for all these different records, and the person who sells a lot of records, they're paying for the ones that didn't sell so much. But it enabled the record companies to do some innovative things to keep that balance, like what you're talking about. Well, when Napster happened, now Google started in 1998, Napster probably shortly thereafter, I forget exactly the date. The record companies totally started panicking because all of a sudden, you know, their sales, things were being shared freely on the internet and people were being laid off. That's when my friend enters, Brian Camilio, and he says to me one day, what's the one thing nobody can file share? And I said, I don't know. And he said, the creative process. If I create a website where you announce ahead of time you're going to make a record, and then you create different levels in which people can participate in that, I could create a website that would allow them to log in and see behind the scenes so that people become close to the process of making music. And then they can see you in the process of making the record over the months and follow along. They pre-order. Crowdfunding word hadn't been invented. And then when the record comes out, you know, you continue to sell it and people can get that extra content. He said, if we do it, we won't put it in stores because those are anonymous sales. If we sell directly, you know every person who buys your music, and you can continue to sell to them on your next project. And I was frustrated because I was one of those people who was selling a lot of records. And my records were probably helping pay for some other people. I mean, it's not like they were huge sellers, but they were doing well. And I wanted to start having an extra day in the studio and paying, you know, having a bigger budget and doing things the way I wanted to do it. And doing special things in the packaging maybe or whatever. And so I decided to go that route. And that was that album that has Concert in the Garden. it won a Grammy. It was at the Grammys. You know, when you win a Grammy, you go backstage and they have a room full of journalists like this, except you've all got computers and there's a lot more of them. And then you stand there and they're, you know, upset because it was, you're not Alicia Keys, you're Maria Schneider from jazz. Ugh, boring, you know. So there's like Maria Schneider, large jazz ensemble, and then you're waiting for somebody to ask you a question and they all just sit and look at you because they really don't care. So I was like, oh my God, this is, I was on top of the world and now I'm on the bottom, you know. And so then they shuffled me to another room of humiliation and there's more journalists, you know, and they give you the new shiny Grammy, Maria Schneider, large jazz ensemble. And then I stood there and a journalist from Minneapolis says, hey, I'm from the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. The people at home must be really excited. You must feel really proud. You just tell us about it. And I said, yeah. And I was like, thank God, you know, somebody cares. I said, I'm especially excited because this is the first Grammy that was won by somebody only selling on the internet because we didn't put it in Tower or anything.
Were you the first?
The first. And so somebody said, is that true? And I said, well, you can fact check it, but yeah. You know, who else was selling on the internet? Everybody in the business told me I was crazy, all these executives and stuff. They said, nobody's going to buy through the internet. Because that was, most people were dial-up back then, you know? We were mailing everything out. I was mailing them myself, going to the post. Oh, I was crazy. Anyway, all of a sudden, everybody's typing. It came out in Russia. It came out in Argentina. An old friend of mine in Argentina wrote to me, Maria, I'm scared. They're going to find you in the East River. Nobody likes it when people do things like this, you know, because it was showing we didn't need the record companies. And I started saying, this is the best time for the artist. I was selling a third the records that I normally sold, and I was making so much more. You know, you make $15 a record and you sell 10,000 of them, because I was selling like 30,000 before. You sell your first 10,000, that's $150,000, you know? I mean, and that doesn't include the gold, silver participants, all that stuff. And so it was just amazing. And I said to everybody, it's the age of the artist. You bank on yourself. You take on your own risk. You want to do something innovative, you know? You're taking the risk. And if people don't come on with the pre-orders, maybe you stop and give them their money back or whatever. So it went great. We didn't even think to say it was the first crowdfunded. We called it fan funding. We just didn't even know. So then what happens a few years later? YouTube starts. All of a sudden, I'm looking. The first thing I saw on YouTube was a Thad Jones video. I was like, well, who cleared the rights for this? I mean, we've been talking a lot about rights. I was like, how did somebody get the rights to put that up for free? And then more and more things. All of a sudden, there's this feeding frenzy of free music. It's like a buffet. It's like saying to the world, here, we're going to put this buffet of free all-you-can-eat food out there. You know, well, good luck, you restaurants, you know, trying to sell food, you know. And it was just horrible for musicians. And it was horrible for the record companies. But then the record companies made a deal. They made a deal with YouTube, where YouTube had this fingerprinting technology where you could put your music into a database, and then somebody else, if they put that music up, it would recognize it as being the same, and then it would... You could have it blocked, so it couldn't be put up. But YouTube got the idea to use the technology for when it recognized it, saying to the record companies, hey, we could put an ad on it, and you'll get a portion of the revenue. And these record companies that were on their knees and had old back catalogs that weren't selling that much anyway, they made a deal with the devil, basically, to give over their catalogs to these things and trade music for ads, which is a pittance. Now, if you're a huge viral artist, it might add up to something. But for somebody like me, who's making recordings that are very niche, small audiences, I may have won the Grammys and, you know, Pulitzer nomination or whatever, or finalist or whatever that is. But it's a really small audience when you're talking in terms of what streaming brings. And so at that point, you know, we're gone. So and then I was like, man, these big data, and why are they doing it? The big data companies were doing it because then Google bought YouTube. The big companies wanted these companies because what they need, what their value is data. Their currency is data. And so what they needed is are all those eyeballs coming to their site so that they can start sucking the data off of everybody and using our music as chum, basically. You know, it's like, it really is. I picture cutting up the fish. You know, have you ever seen people fishing with chum? You know, it's like, and that's what they do. And then they use us. And so, you know, and I saw this going nowhere good fast. And so Naris reached out to me about testifying before Congress. I've written a lot of letters. You can find them on my website. It says blog. It's not really a blog. They're kind of my white papers or articles I've written on the subject. And now we know what it's doing to the world, the minds of young people, making people addicted, political polarization. If you haven't seen the movie, The Social Dilemma, you should watch it, you know, in realizing just what it's done to our world. And so then, you know, out of that came my album, Data Lords, which is, you know, pretty dark, intense music. Partly came because having worked with David Bowie, too, he gave me that permission to bring the dark back in. And then the other album is When You Pull Away and Remind Ourselves What Brings Us Beauty and Joy, and that mm-hmm. can't happen when it's all about manipulation, you know? It's like I wrote a series of couplets at the beginning, you know, the story of two worlds. One manipulates the minds of man. The other gives freedom of thought. You know, it's all these things. And it's true, you know, one demands your attention and fights for your attention. The other simply awaits it. Nature doesn't fight for your attention, but it's there. And if you go into it, it's like, oh, wow. You know, and that's the world we live in, this world of just sucking, manipulating, telling you, giving you answers as opposed to leaving you with unanswered questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. I just want to thank you for sharing with us. And you shared some personal things, too. I appreciate that. I've been inspired all this week by your music, as you know. The musicians have. I mean, don't talk to me, talk to Pete, and he can tell you about how we are moved by the fact that we get to share in this experience of the beauty of your music. So everybody here, you know, I just want you to share, if you can, we have two more shows tonight and then tomorrow afternoon. And please call and tell your friends that this is something special, it's something different, and to open your heart, your body, your mind, your soul, and your spirit as you listen to it, and listen to it with no pre-planned agenda, and just like open your heart. And what I feel is that things I talked about before that I get from your music, love, hope, healing. But I think I told you after first rehearsal, like, you know, I come into rehearsal, it's a little stressful, but I left feeling better. And I think that every night that happens to me, mm-hmm. I'm in the car, I'm like, I can breathe now, like,
yeah,
you know, because the music does that to you. And I want everybody to experience your music and great music in general, because I think it has the power to transform us. So I have been transformed by your music this week. I'm so sad my daughter, who wasn't feeling well, I want her here because you're an example for me, but I think you're also a powerful example for women. I live with three women. I have two daughters, my wife, and my dog is even a woman.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You know who runs the house, and not me. But I want them to see your courage on display and the power of women, and our staff is largely women, too, and they kick butt. You know, and they take care of business. And so I'm honored to be here with you. I want you guys to share that musically when you come to hear, if you haven't yet heard Maria, you are simply spectacular, and you're changing lives through what you do every day through your music. And I just want to, on behalf of even everybody here, thank you for your greatness and for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Byron. Thank you.
I mean, we have time. If we have 2 seconds, if anybody has a question, you know, I'm sure Maria will answer a couple.
Yeah, happy to answer any question.
I wanted to ask a question about you mentioned film scoring, and you when we saw your music the other evening, you were scoring these beautiful poems, and I really thought it was beautiful. But what's your ambition toward or experience with film scoring?
You know, I sort of dropped that out of my life. I mean, for one, film scoring is one of those things where they finish the film and the last person in line is the musician, you know, the composer, and it's just a massively stressful world. And I don't know that I want to do that to myself. But the other thing is that when you write, I think I would be really good at film scoring, so maybe...
You definitely.
But there would be one danger, and that is, and but I think I would be conscious of it, is that my music depicts things, but when you have picture, and then you have music, the music can overplay the picture, you know. It can become kind of ridiculous if the music is too much of what. Sometimes the music has to almost play against the picture, you know. So. You know, people always say, oh, your music, it's like film scoring. It's like, yeah, it's like film scoring with the picture there, too. You know, I'd have to kind of extract, pull back. But I love collaboration. You know, I really love, I'm a social animal. I love collaboration. So I could imagine if there was a film, if there was a director, a film, if it was very artistically put together, so there wasn't that huge time crunch pressure, and they were looking for something really unique, then maybe. But, you know, it's, I kind of lost it as my wish when once I got so fulfilled just having a band. Who would think you could find so much love and joy in having a big band, you know? I mean, you have it now too, you know? It's like, I didn't plan it. It wasn't like it was a huge goal of mine. The film scoring was more of a goal, but then I fell into it, and you know, it just kind of, your life takes on a trajectory sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, all that's so.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Anybody else?
I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Your Dad of Lords, the CD. Just the way it's put together in terms of the artistic part of it.
The design, it's beautiful, right?
With the pictures.
Yeah.
I'm one of these throwbacks that, you know, I used to love the liner notes.
Me
on
too.
LPs,
yeah.
And, you know, and there were certain works that just, I remember like Quadrophenia from The Who was one of the first that had all these pictures, and it was a story as well.
Yeah.
So is that a theme that's consistent, or are you trying to do more of that?
Yeah, my feeling was when everybody started saying we need to cut back because the revenues aren't there anymore, mm-hmm. when everybody said we should do less, I said, I'm doing more, mm-hmm. you know, because it's my money at risk. I'm not playing with other people's money. I'm going to take the risk. And I want the highest quality. So the artist on that is a guy from my hometown, from Windham, Minnesota. He's unbelievable. That leaf on the front is painted. That's not a photograph. That's a cottonwood leaf from our... We lived in Cottonwood County, so that's the image of the nature with the you know, circuitry and everything. And then the designer... the designer I met at a... Sherry Dorr is her name. I met her at a farmer's market. And she came up to me and she said, are you Maria Schneider? And I said, yeah. And she said, oh, I love your music. And she said, you know, I design. And she said, I'd love to do something with you. And then she said, I'm really good. And the way she said it, I love when people can just say, I'm really good. You know, it's just like, let's cut through the bullshit. She's really good, and I could tell when she said it, she was really good, especially when I went online and she didn't have some big, you know, website showing who she... I just saw a few things about people she'd worked with, and I was like, okay, I'm going with her. And so now she is just like, she's my designer. And I like making something of beauty that feels, that looks. It's not, for me, it's not just the music. It's the whole thing, you know. I have as much fun working with her on the package, you know, and for sure, you know.
What comes through, I mean, that was a gift. You know, not just buying a piece of music, it was a gift to go through it.
Yeah, I know. I'm glad you appreciate it, because I have fun making it, for sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, Maria Schneider.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. Our theme music is titled 3-4 Times by Michael Cox. This episode was recorded and edited by Mercedes Aviles.